33,200. Aid workers begin searching for bodies at Gaza's Al-Shifa Hospital, following the Israeli carnage at the medical facility. And the top UN court holds the second and final day of hearings on a case brought by Nicaragua against Germany over its support for Israel's war in Gaza. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Palestinians are witnessing an endless spiral of death and devastation in Gaza, where U.S. Israeli genocide is now in its seventh month. Israeli aircraft and artillery fire continued in various parts of the Gaza Strip, targeting homes and gatherings of displaced people and killing over 30 people in the past day. The mayor of Al-Maghazi and several others were killed when the regime hit central Gaza. To the south, horrors are continuing even after Israeli occupation forces left the city of Khan Yunis on Sunday. So far, 84 bodies have been recovered from under the rubble. Palestinian medical sources say the regime has also significantly damaged the city's hospital and equipment. Since the start of the U.S.-Israeli onslaught on October 7, over 33,200 people have been killed in Gaza. Aid workers have begun searching for the bodies from the rubble of Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza after 2 weeks of Israeli attacks on the medical complex. According to relief teams associated with the World Health Organization, the hospital was reduced to ashes by airstrikes and shelling. So far, at least 400 bodies have been discovered. Many patients have died inside the hospital as a result of the Israeli siege on the complex. Israeli forces pulled out of Gaza's largest hospital on Monday. They laid siege to the building and carried out attacks under the pretext that Hamas fighters were operating from there. But the resistance movement has repeatedly denied having any of its fighters inside Al-Shifa or other health facilities. Some aid workers tell about the lack of equipment to plow through the rubble of Al-Shifa Hospital, where some recount the horror that they experienced at the medical complex. Let's take a listen.
When the Israeli army entered within a minute or two, they surrounded the entire area. And after that, they started using the loudspeaker to say, "This is the IDF. The entire area is surrounded and everyone must surrender." Then they started shooting at all the entrances, preventing anyone from moving. I spent 4 days there with my two little daughters, without any food or water. They cried from the hunger. And when they arrested my husband, he had not eaten for 3 days.
The relatives wish to ascertain the fate of their sons, whether they have been killed or missing or have been displaced to the south. The relatives are present to identify their sons and ensure they receive a proper burial. However, we lack the necessary equipment for this task, and time is not on our side. We must complete the job before the bodies decompose.
There are challenges in the Gaza Strip. We don't have forensic doctors or organizations that document the crimes of the Israeli occupation forces. We try to utilize the expertise of the World Health Organization and the UN Humanitarian Office in documenting the crime which occurred inside the Al-Shifa medical complex. The stench of death is everywhere. We try with the help of the delegation of the UN Humanitarian Office and the delegation of the World Health Organization to dig the mass graves in Al-Shifa complex and to identify the decomposed bodies and the body parts that were crushed by the Israeli occupation forces. We try to identify these bodies and document these crimes which were committed against these civilians.
Our correspondent Muti Abu Musaba joined us earlier from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah. He gave us details about the situation in Gaza, including the southern city of Khan Yunis, where Israeli forces withdrew from several days ago.
Given that the destruction there is massive, we can see that roughly 80% of the residential buildings and facilities were completely or partially destroyed. This reflects that there is hundreds of the Palestinian civilians are still trapped and missing under the rubble of those destroyed houses. And this means that the number of the Palestinian civilians who were killed over the attack will be massive. And as you know, that the the civil defense crews, they are searching for those dead bodies, and they are trying to extract those dead bodies, having their basic tools, and they are using their bare hands in order to extract those dead bodies. So this actually complicates the process, and this complicates the extraction of those dead bodies. We can see that what happened in Khan Yunis is unprecedented in terms of the massive destruction and mass slaughter of the people there. And even when it comes to Gaza City and the northern part of Gaza Strip, the destruction that was inflicted in those areas by the Israeli occupation forces is nothing compared to what happened and took place in Khan Yunis City. What happened in Khan Yunis City is horrific, because as you know, that everything was breached by the Israeli occupation forces was targeted and destroyed. This included actually the residential buildings, the infrastructure, the pipelines, and everything. Everything was targeted and destroyed by the Israeli occupation forces.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the proposal reached during the latest round of Gaza ceasefire talks does not meet the movement's and Palestinians' demands. Hamas says Israel's position in the negotiations held in Egypt remains stubborn. The movement, however, said that it is still studying the proposal and will inform mediators of its response once it is completely reviewed. Hamas did not set any time frame for its response. The movement says that it wants a comprehensive ceasefire that would see the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza and the return of Gazans to their homes. The humanitarian situation in Gaza is a main topic as well. The Cairo talks were attended by delegations from Israel, Hamas, Qatar, and the United States. The International Court of Justice is holding a second of proceedings on a case brought by Nicaragua against Germany over arms exports to Israel. Nicaragua argued on the first day of hearings on Monday that Germany is facilitating the Israeli genocide in Gaza by providing weapons to the regime. The Nicaraguan ambassador accused German arms industries of making profits from the devastating situation in Gaza. Carlos Jose Gomez also pointed out to Germany's defunding of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, saying the move showed Berlin's support for the bloodshed in Gaza. Germany has defended itself in the claim, saying that Israel's security is at the core of Berlin's foreign policy. Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has hailed Nicaragua for filing the petition against Germany. It called on other countries to follow the example of Nicaragua and South Africa in taking actions against the genocide in Gaza. Radio political commentator Khalid Syed joined us with his take on Nicaragua's case at the top UN court against Germany over its support for the Israeli war on Gaza.
It's an extremely important move that has been made by Nicaragua, very much in line with what our government has done with regards to taking Israel to the International Criminal Court, or no, to the International Court of Justice, rather. So I think it's, number one, it will result again in the narrative around the involvement of European countries in aiding and abetting genocide being put out there much better in the public domain. Perceptions will be changed, and I think it will most certainly have an impact on the German population. And the German population will then put pressure on their government as a result of it. So most certainly, it will yield results. As you saw with what happened when South Africa went to the International Court of Justice, it shaped more public opinion against the state of Israel. So it's most certainly going to have that effect. And I think we need to commend Nicaragua and actually encourage more and more countries to do the same as Nicaragua has done, following in South Africa's tone.
Iraqi resistance groups say that they have carried out fresh military operations against five vital Israeli targets, retaliation for the regime's massacre of Palestinians in Gaza. The Islamic resistance in Iraq says the targets hit include the Ascalon oil port and the Hadzerim air base in the city of Beersheba. The Umbrella resistance group also vowed to continue targeting enemy strongholds. In recent months, the Islamic resistance in Iraq has carried out a series of attacks against Israeli targets. It has also hit U.S. military bases in Iraq and neighboring Syria, retaliation for Washington's complicity in the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Turkey says it has imposed trade restrictions on Israel starting Tuesday in response to the regime's ongoing onslaught in the Gaza Strip. In a statement, the Turkish Trade Ministry said the export ban has been imposed on a range of products, including construction materials like cement, iron, and steel. It added that the decision will remain in place until Israel declares a ceasefire immediately and allows adequate and uninterrupted flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza. This as the Turkish government has been facing public criticism over its double standards as Ankara continues its trade with Israel while at the same time condemns attacks on Gaza. Over the past months, major Turkish cities have witnessed a number of protests against Israel's genocidal war in Gaza. The Secretary General of the Hezbollah Resistance Movement says that Iran has every right to retaliate the recent Israeli attack on its embassy in Syria.
In the end, the Americans have come to the conclusion that there will be a reaction. Even the Israelis, they have come to this conclusion. They have recognized that there will be, I think the whole world has, that this is a natural right for Iran and that it's normal for the Islamic Republic to go ahead with such a retaliation. But of course, everyone's waiting what will happen and the repercussions of what will happen.
Nasrallah made the comments in a ceremony held in commemoration of Iranian Major General Mohammad Reza Zahedi, who was killed along with a number of his companions in Damascus. The Hezbollah chief said Israel's stupidity in attacking the Iranian embassy made the U.S. president press Israel to stop the onslaught on Gaza. Nasrallah said Israel has achieved nothing on the ground in Gaza in the past 6 months and has no choice but to stop the genocidal war. Nasrallah also cited Israel's deteriorating situation in the world and its isolation due to its aggression against Palestinians. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has visited Syria a week after the Israeli attack on Iran's embassy in Damascus. He met with President Bashar al-Assad and Syria's Foreign Minister to discuss the latest developments. Ibrahim Mahdi reports from Damascus.
In a significant visit as part of his regional tour, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian arrived in Damascus this Monday. Amir Abdollahian met with President Bashar al-Assad, who considered the Israeli attack against the Iranian embassy and the regime's ongoing genocide in Gaza a proof of Israel's failure in achieving any military objectives. Amir Abdollahian highlighted that the Israeli regime is facing its worst times due to the Palestinian resistance, which stands ready to continue its battle against Israel's atrocities.
I have discussed with President Bashar al-Assad a series of events, especially the events in Palestine and the crime that Israel committed against the Iranian consulate in Damascus. This terrorist crime was committed with US-made fighter jets and missiles. Therefore, the US is involved. Israel will receive the due response for its aggression against our consulate in Damascus.
Amir Abdollahian and his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad inspected the Iranian consulate struck by the Israeli regime. They later inaugurated the new Iranian consulate in Syria.
The Israeli aggression against the Iranian consulate in Damascus is a violation of international law and all values on which humanity was founded. The Israeli enemy tries to expand the war due to its complete failure in Gaza. Syria firmly supports the resistance in Gaza and all the resistance movements in the region.
The Iranian foreign minister also stressed that Iran will spare no efforts to stop the genocidal war in Gaza, support its resistance, and deliver humanitarian aid. He concluded his visit at Muassa Hospital to check in on the wounded of the Israeli aggression and express his heartfelt thoughts. This visit comes within the context of Iran's diplomatic efforts to stop the Israeli onslaught in Gaza, and also to reaffirm Iran's right of retaliation for the Israeli heinous crime against the Iranian embassy. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Recent polls in many Western countries show that Israel's atrocities in Gaza have had an unprecedented impact. The French President Emmanuel Macron continues to give unconditional support to Tel Aviv, but the French public opinion has shifted towards Palestine since October 7. Ramin Mazari has more from Paris.
Highly politicized French polling agencies have rarely dared to make surveys on Palestine, but after 6 months of attempted genocide, a new poll shows public opinion dramatically shifting against Israel. Since October, support for Israel's plan to eliminate Hamas has dropped from 65 to 56%, while condemnation for Israel's war aim has jumped from 35 to 44%. Following the mainstreaming of Islamophobia, France had become an ardently pro-Zionist country, But the polls show that a nation evenly split on support for Palestine isn't far away.
Here in France, we have many stars and actors who are Arabs and Muslims, but who don't say a word about Palestine and who don't support the Palestinian cause openly. It's a shame because they could have a big impact on the French public. Instead, they shut themselves up.
Israel is illegitimate and has no right to exist. Palestine is unjustly occupied, and I don't see how anyone can fail to see that. I'm waiting for Iran and Hezbollah to do their work and for Israel to get out.
As Palestinians return to the city of Khan Yunis, Gaza's second largest city, the results of 6 months of war are catastrophic. Israel has killed over 33,000 people and wounded 80,000 others in Gaza, the West Bank, and Lebanon. Famine is affecting half of Gaza's 2.2 million people, while some two-thirds of the nation's buildings have been reduced to rubble.
This war really has to stop. People are forgetting that the Palestinians are humans, just like everyone else. There are just horrible things going on for women and children, and there has to be peace immediately.
After 6 months, the United Nations Human Rights Council finally took a position on the horrific invasion. They called for a halt in all arms sales to Israel and for Israel to be held accountable for possible war crimes and crimes against humanity. Many attribute the Western public's shift against Israel not to the mainstream media or brave politicians, but to the gruesome and heartbreaking images being relayed on social and alternative media. Images of the human costs of the West's support for Tel Aviv have long been censored. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah on the blessed month of Ramadan, March 12, 2024. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. All praise is due to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master and our Prophet, Abul Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad, and his untainted, pure, chosen, guiding, and well-guided, immaculate progeny, particularly the remnant of God on earth. You are very welcome here. Our session today, praise God, had the needed number of people. It was very good, complete, and comprehensive. I sincerely thank the organizers of this meeting as well as all the contributors who made this gathering splendid, meaningful, and remarkable. I would like to thank each and every one of those who recited the Quran and performed in this program. Fortunately, the recitation of the Quran being done in the correct manner and according to the rules and regulations of recitation is steadily becoming more widespread in the country. Perhaps there is not a day that goes by where I do not thank Almighty God for this great blessing.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Whenever I turn on the TV, one of the esteemed reciters of the Quran, some of whom are present here too, or a number of reciters who recite using the tartil, a method of recitation, are busy reciting. I sit and listen to them with great pleasure while thanking God. These have been granted to us due to the blessings of the revolution. When we compare our country with other Islamic countries, now I can't say for certain and I don't have exact statistics, but I believe that the number of well-reciting, proficient reciters in our country may exceed that of all other Islamic countries. Perhaps there may be some exceptions to this general rule in a certain country, but from what we hear and occasionally witness, the rest of the world cannot be compared to the skill and talent of our youth, to you, our beloved reciters, and our cherished ones. The value and greatness of reciting the Quran should be understood from the greatness of the Quran itself. You can see in the Quran itself what titles and designations are used to introduce the Quran. I have made a note of a few examples, such as the Great Quran, the Noble Quran, the Clear Quran, the Glorious Quran, the Wise Quran, the Healing Quran, the Merciful Quran, the Luminous Quran, and other similar titles.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
In May 1945, a group of experts prepared a base to detonate 100 tons of TNT. They were busy finding an appropriate criterion to measure a huge bomb in Alamogordo, New Mexico. The volume of the explosives should have been so large to simulate the main test. In the middle of all this, the differences of opinion between two groups of scientists over the secretive Manhattan Project grew larger. This group of scientists, who were supposed to change the mid-20th century's fate, could not reach an agreement on a certain issue. Most of them were of the opinion that after making an atomic bomb, the United States should put its power on display at night for Japanese envoys in order to make the Japanese emperor surrender by threatening him with the bomb. However, theoretical physicist Edward Teller insisted on testing the atomic bomb on a city to learn about its effects on its population.
The American people in their right.
The only thing that could put an end to the differences was the speech by then U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt for the scientist. It tipped the balance in favor of Teller.
Among other things, and at the climax, he said, "You scientists are blamed for the weapons to be used. But I tell you that if you now won't work on weapons, the freedom of the world will be lost." Now, you know, I had the feeling that Roosevelt was talking to me. I was there when the letter was signed that awoke his interest in nuclear energy. I thought I knew he was talking about nuclear energy. Of the 2,000 scientists there, I felt he was talking to me.
Some people consider Edward Teller as a clear example of a mad scientist. Many critics believe that Stanley Kubrick was inspired by Edward Teller to create the notorious character Dr. Strangelove.
The report, my conclusion, was that this idea was not a practical deterrent for reasons which at this moment must be all too obvious.
Then you mean it is possible for them to have built such a thing?
Mr. President, the technology required is easily within the means of even the smallest nuclear power. It requires only the will to do so.
After the TNT explosion test, it was eventually decided that the first bomb should go off in Alamogordo, which is located 230 miles south of New Mexico in Los Alamos. The operation was codenamed Trinity. The codename comes from the belief in the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit in Christianity. They were planning to launch the largest massacre of human beings in the name of Jesus. This 21-ton bomb was 200 times stronger than the calibration test. The light was so intense that could immediately cause blindness. It was visible within the radius of 16 kilometers. It melted the sands in the desert and turned them into green crystals. The radioactive effects remained in the region for 50 years. Before the bomb was tested, two other bombs named Little Boy and Fat Man were secretly taken to Oceania to be prepared for an attack on two Japanese cities. It was 8:15 a.m. local time on August 6, 1945. The first bomb, Little Boy, was dropped on Hiroshima by a bomber named Enola Gay. For the bomber to have enough time to flee the explosion, they dropped the bomb via a parachute. To make the detonation stronger, the bomb was set to go off 576 meters above the ground. Those who saw Little Boy explode mid-air from a distance said they saw a new sun in the sky. After the blast, two-thirds of the buildings in Hiroshima, including steelmaking and industrial factories, were completely destroyed. The only thing that was left standing in the city was the Hiroshima Prefectural Industrial Promotion Hall. The explosion happened on top of the building's dome, and as it was within the central focus of the blast, it was not completely devastated. The moment the bomb went off, about 100,000 residents in Hiroshima died on the spot. While Japan was in shock and the Japanese people had almost realized that they were defeated, then U.S. President Harry Truman announced that this bomb was just a warning. 3 days later, another bomb was detonated in Nagasaki, which claimed the lives of 40,000 people in that city. Next day, Japan conceded defeat and surrendered to U.S. conditions to end the war. In the following years, more people succumbed to injuries sustained after the explosion due to radiation. Even though the U.S. honored its forces who were involved in the Manhattan Project and the agents in the carnage were awarded, the events pushed the public to rise up against nuclear weapons. The harms caused by the newly invented elements were not always sudden and tangible like atomic bombs. The start of nuclear war dated back to 50 years before when radioactive material was first discovered. In the spring of 1896, Marie Curie and her husband, Pierre Curie, discovered the amazing characteristics of some mineral stones, including uranium. They realized that the elements in the stones emit radiations that are not visible but pass through many barriers. The radiation was named gamma. After her husband's death, Marie Curie continued her research in 1910. It led to the discovery of radium as a new radioactive element.
Madame Curie.
The discovery made her the first woman to receive the Nobel Prize twice. But the award cost Marie Curie a lot. Many doctors say she was a victim of radioactive material, especially radium, during her experiments in the lab. The possibility was raised in the following years because back then nuclear scientists did not know anything about the harmful effects of nuclear material. It caused bigger catastrophe. The discovery of radium among natural radioactive elements with the half-life of about 1600 years left everyone in astonishment. The element's strange radiation added new color to advertisement in the West. Since the damage caused by the element and its radiation hadn't come to light yet, opportunistic traders sought to fulfill people's demands with these elements. They claim that this dangerous material can help him live longer and healthier, so they introduced it to people's daily lives. They were used in the most sensitive cosmetic and hygienic products, including body lotions, lipsticks, toothpaste, and even water, bread, and chocolate. They claim that radium as an ingredient in products is considered something positive. On the other hand, in 1917, the United States had just been involved in World War I. The army needed clocks whose hands were luminous at night in the dark. So factories across the U.S. took up the job and started producing clocks. To paint the tiny impact numbers on the clock's screen, they instructed female workers to press the tip of the brush with their lips in order to keep it tiny. They were told that working with radium paint was not hazardous. After a while, some of the workers were diagnosed with strange diseases. They would go to the dentist to pull their decayed teeth, but not only wouldn't they be cured, their teeth would get injured. Things gradually got worse. After dentists touched their jaws, they would get injured. Many of them had cancerous tumors in their bones and they would easily break. The first person who died was a 25-year-old woman named Amelia Maggia, nicknamed Molly. She succumbed to the disease in less than a year. The doctors didn't have an answer to her mysterious death. Gradually, as more and more female workers came down with illness, they pieced together the puzzle and found out that radium was the reason behind the deadly disease. Although after 5 or 6 years in the mid-30s, advertising products that contained radioactive element and using them in products were altogether banned, their effects continued to last. After the atomic bombing in the World War, the radium girls and similar incidents like the Chernobyl disaster in Ukraine in 1986 and the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster in 2011 after the 8.9 strong earthquake The international community rose up against nuclear energy. But the question is, why do countries, even Japan that was subject to the biggest atomic curse, not give up nuclear energy? Why does a country like Iran make so much effort and spend so much money to achieve such an apparently dangerous energy? West Asia is known for its wars. The wars were initially waged under different excuses, but they usually pursue the same goal, and that is oil. The United States' latest direct war in the region was launched in 2003. The U.S. invaded Iraq under the pretext that the country possessed weapons of mass destruction, like biological and nuclear bombs. But after years of war and bloodshed, no weapons that were used as a pretext to invade the country were found. Even though no unconventional weapons were found in the country, it was rich in oil resources that was hugely extracted. After the invasion, oil was extracted and used to push U.S. policies and economy forward. The U.S. dealt with Iraq and raised accusations that are somehow similar to Israel's behavior vis-a-vis Iran.
This is a few. That Iran has another secret facility in Tehran, a secret atomic warehouse for storing massive amounts of equipment and material from Iran's secret nuclear weapons program. We exposed the site of Iran's secret atomic archive. It's right here, in the Shorabad district of Tehran. Today, I'm revealing the site of a second facility, Iran's secret atomic warehouse. It's right here, in the Turquzabad district of Tehran, just 3 miles away.
The Turquzabad carpet washing center was Netanyahu's last trick for the media to get the international community on board his Iranophobia scheme for, quote, possessing nuclear weapons. But the Israeli regime did not stop there at the media campaign level. To date, it has assassinated top Iranian nuclear scientists. He's someone who doesn't want to realize that based on numerous inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, and the religious views of the Iranian leader, it is not after nuclear weapons.
As of today, I can state that Iran is implementing its nuclear-related commitments. We have had access to all the sites and locations which we needed to visit.
So why does Israel keep insisting on the accusation and pursue such confrontational policies with Iran to stop the country from reaching nuclear technology? Is it possible that the objections are just excuses? Just like what happened in Iraq? How can the energy benefit Iran that the Israeli regime does everything it can to stop it from reaching the technology? It was exactly 6 years after the first and last nuclear bomb blast that a national lab in Idaho was lit up by only 4 200-watt light bulbs. Even though the EBR-1 project's goal was not to generate electricity, it corroborated theories concerning producing electricity from nuclear energy. The system, which was more complicated than making an atomic bomb, was later named nuclear reactor. The reactors could easily provide electricity for a city or more without constructing huge dams or consuming thousands of tons of charcoal and emitting pollutant gases. 70 years after the 4 famous light bulbs in Idaho were lit up, a little further away, Bill Gates, as the richest man on the planet and the owner of Microsoft, was investing on nuclear reactors that could work for 60 years after fueling just once. Today, reactors have considerably reduced consumption of oil condensates for producing energy. For example, the 1,000 megawatt reactor in Iran's Bushehr has saved 47 million barrels of oil that would otherwise be used for generating electricity in 7 years. In Europe, generating electricity is the foremost goal of using nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. But in Asia, there is a more burning issue, and that is water. West Asia is among the driest regions in the continent. It has only 1% of fresh water resources in the world. Many analysts believe that the next wars in the region will not be over oil. They say water is a serious concern in this part of the world. In this dry region, Israel has managed to export its agricultural products to all across the world, besides meeting 95% of its population's demands. The Israeli regime does not have underground water resources or many rivers. However, it has tipped environmental balance in its own favor by using nuclear technology to rein in nature. On the shores of the Red Sea, the saline water is desalinated for agriculture and drinking. As an example, Sorek, as the largest water treatment plant in the world, located 15 kilometers south of Tel Aviv, can purify 230 million cubic meters of water and tackle water shortage to a great extent. This amount of water is equal to the water Iran annually receives from the Karajan Latian dams for drinking and agriculture in Tehran and Elbourz provinces, with a population of about 15 million people. Even though only 20% of the land occupied by the Israeli regime is arable, today it has become an agricultural hub.
This is the finished product, desalinated water. And according to the officials here at the plant, it's a more complete water than water that hasn't had the saline removed, because in the process of desalination, minerals are added back.
It seems the Israeli regime and Washington are seeking to stop Iran from accessing nuclear energy, not because they are worried it might make a nuclear bomb, but they are concerned that Iran might achieve the nuclear technology that can strengthen its independence and tackle millions of Iranians' needs. Water and energy are among the most vital necessities in agriculture and other industries, and even if a country like Iran does not need nuclear energy to fulfill its needs, it still cannot forego the energy. If the fruit produced by farmers goes bad before reaching the market, it will bring nothing but financial loss and physical exhaustion. Many kinds of fruit cannot resist against natural bacteria and fungus as they quickly go bad. Today, the key to reach the market, especially the international one, is in the hand of irradiation. Thanks to nuclear technology, radiation technology has been around for 60 years and is used in the agriculture industry. Exposing fruits to the light emission of radiation for a short time can destroy the larvae and bacteria in fruits and increase its shelf life. Today, many agricultural products and even fruits like strawberry that have very short shelf life are exported to other countries. Exposing fruits to the gamma ray at entry points and quarantine centers of a country can stop the spread of insects and pests.
We have to look at the taste, the color, the granulometry. Is there some foreign material? And also we look at the microbiology. Spices can be contaminated up to 1 million bacteria per gram. And with the irradiation, it can reduce by 99.9%.
other treatment will not offer that kind of reduction. Irradiation for us will not change the taste, the color, will not leave any residue, and also is really lowering the microbiological count.
When we piece together different problems like medical treatment, industrial experiments, and other issues a country can resolve by using a nuclear technology, we find out that there is a good reason behind Iran's political and economic battle to achieve the technology. Today, if a country wants to guarantee its economic, scientific, and technological future, it needs to step in this field.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned.
یا ایها الذین آمنوا یعنی تو چرا بنده من کسانی که به من رابطه دارید ایمان دارید.
Regarding the holy month of Ramadan, the Holy Quran states, O you who have faith, prescribed for you is fasting as it was prescribed for those who were before you, so that you may be God-weary. Out of 365 days of a year, the Muslims are only obliged to fast for 30 days. This means that Allah does not want His people to be afflicted with hardships. Also, Allah banned the sick people or travelers from fasting during the month of Ramadan. This means that Allah wants His people to experience one of the best deeds of Islam in the most beautiful and sweet ways. In other words, Allah desires that the people taste the sweetness of fasting without having any type of fear in their hearts and soul. Thus, there is no type of force in the tone of Allah to oblige His people to fast. In the Holy Quran, there is no compulsion in the words of Allah regarding fasting during the holy month of Ramadan. Although fasting is an obligation for all the Muslims, Allah does not want to force His people to fast. We must learn how to preach Islam from the Holy Quran. Four of the important commands of Islam were established 15 years after the advent of Islam. These four deeds include paying homes and paying zakat, jihad, and fasting. This is a big lesson for us. Thank you very much, dear listeners of iRab English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qarati. To find out more about this program, please log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, Muslims across the world have spent the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan marking Al-Quds Day. The day was designated by Imam al-Khomeini, who commanded Muslims to institute this day in order to always keep the cause of Palestine fresh in the hearts and minds of Muslims everywhere. This episode will discuss Al-Quds Day, in particular in the context of the extra importance it takes with regards to the current genocidal war Israel is waging on the people of Palestine. First, we take a look at the ideology of Imam al-Khomeini with regards to Palestine and what drove him to institute Al-Quds Day.
The Zionist occupation of Palestine was preceded by the injection of the poison of nationalism, a concept totally alien to the Quranic concept of the Ummah, the single faith community. The ideology of Arab nationalism fragmented the Muslim masses when they were confronted by Zionist nationalism in a conflict over control of Palestine, as they could only be mobilized on the basis of Islam, not on the basis of an alien ideology imported from the West. The Western powers pursued a long-term strategy, first defeating the Ottoman Empire and then planting their agents in the fragmented body of the Ummah in the global south. Muslims ended up with traitorous rulers who were nurtured by the colonialist powers and are therefore loyal to them. David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister, candidly admitted that the Arab regimes are Israel's first line of defense. These regimes have continued to suppress the Islamic movement. It was in this grim situation that the Islamic Revolution succeeded in Iran in 1979. Soon thereafter, Imam Khomeini, as the first truly Islamic leader to emerge in the Ummah in the post-colonial period, took a number of decisions that had far-reaching implications. The Islamic State severed all links with the Zionist state and expelled its agents from Iran. The Imam then proclaimed that only the mobilization of Muslim masses would liberate the first Qibla of Islam from the clutches of Zionism. Towards this end, he declared that the last Friday of Ramadan should be marked as Yawm al-Quds, the Day of al-Quds, on which Muslims throughout the world should reaffirm their determination and commitment to end the continued occupation of al-Quds and Palestine by the Zionist invaders. Imam Khomeini located the struggle of the Muslim masses in the very roots of Islam, in the month of Ramadan, where Muslims worldwide not only fast together, but also congregate over the recitation of the Word of God and the remembrance of significant Islamic history and victories, like that of Badr. By observing the Day of Al-Quds, Muslims not only begin to fulfill a political obligation, they also acknowledge a religious one. The protection of Islam's sacred places is a duty that is incumbent upon all Muslims. As long as Al-Quds remains in the clutches of Zionism, this duty remains unfulfilled, and mobilizing the Muslim Ummah toward this objective becomes a religious obligation.
Now, to discuss this important topic are two very special guests. We're honoured to welcome Masood Shajara. Brother Masood is the chair of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, which organises legal support for Muslims targeted by the state. The IHRC has been one of the organisers of the annual Quds Day in London for several decades. We're also honoured to welcome back Sister Noor Fekri to the show. Sister Noor is a politics graduate with a keen interest in West Asian affairs. She uses her social media platform to analyse religious and political events in a way that is accessible to the everyday person. Assalamu alaikum to you both. Thank you for joining us here to discuss what is a really momentous day in the Islamic world and wider, actually. Sister Noor, if I could begin with you. Firstly, we just heard there some of the context behind why Imam Khomeini did establish Quds Day, and I wanted to ask you, like, why did he make such efforts? What was he worried about in terms of perhaps Muslims forgetting the importance of Palestine during that era?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I honestly don't think he thought people would forget Palestine. If you look around today and ask people about Palestine, absolutely everyone is aware of what is going on in Palestine. So I think the Imam actually had an incredible ability of basira, being able to see into the future and foresee that actually people will remember. Al-Quds Day then, we could say 40 years ago, could have been established in order to remind people then, because then the Palestine folder had been put onto the shelves, gathering dust. There were peace agreements that were being made, failed Oslo Accords, constant failed agreements, as though you can agree with the colonizer, as though you can negotiate with the colonizer. And people were starting to forget the Palestinian issue. But he brought it back onto the list of priorities. He made it a top priority. He removed the Israeli occupation entity embassy from Tehran and erected a Palestinian embassy. He recognized Palestine as a state, which is significant, as one state recognizing another. And so back then, he made people remember it through Al-Quds Day. However, today, he made it a reoccurring event. So it's something that happens every single Ramadan, which is, by the way, Islam's holiest month, and on a Friday, which is Islam's holiest day, to unite people in the future. It wasn't necessarily to remind them. And through this unity, he attempted to unite Muslims to counter the sectarianism that the West tried to sort of get people to occupy themselves with. So, for instance, they would occupy people's minds by telling them that Palestinians are Sunnis, and why should Shia Lebanese or Shia Iranians or Zaydi Yemenis defend Palestine? So he, with Al-Quds Day, destroyed the idea of sectarianism and united people through the banner of Palestine in Islam.
Absolutely. And Brother Masood, as the sister rightly mentioned there, you know, there have been attempts to, which persist to this day, to stress and focus on sectarian differences maybe that appear. But, you know, the status of Al-Quds is quite central in Islam itself. What is it about Al-Quds exactly that makes it so important to the religion of Islam and to Muslims around the world?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I mean, the obvious is that it was the first Qibla of Muslims and is one of the holiest sites in Islam. And but I think it goes far beyond that. I mean, what the sister said is absolutely right about the importance of Al-Quds and why it was instigated. I'm old enough to remember it at the time. At that time, the struggle for freedom of Palestine was being shifted between the East and the West. You know, people were going towards Americans and for trying to get Palestinians free.